How many of you can tell me the name of the fast food restaurant that for years used the following slogan? Have it your way. Burger King, right? Have it your way. Burger King. But did you know that in 2014, Burger King announced that it was ditching that slogan? It was no longer going to use the phrase, have it your way. Instead, they were going to use another one. They were going to instead use the phrase, be your way. So switching from have it your way to be your way. And why? Well, they explained in a statement, this is in 2014, they explained that have it your way focuses only on the purchase, the ability to customize your burger. By contrast, be your way is all about making a connection with a person's lifestyle. So how many of you looking for lifestyle connections find yourself at Burger King? Hopefully not many of you. But here's the interesting thing, I think, about Burger King's slogan. So for years, they have been telling customers, we will make your burger any way you want it. Have it your way. So for years, Burger King has been trying to pronounce to everybody, we are going to submit to your wishes as a customer. We are submitting to your wishes, and we will make the burger however way you'd like it. Now, probably most of us expect Burger King to submit to our wishes when we walk in there. But there's also an ugly side, I think, to the whole expectation of a restaurant submitting to our wishes. There's a phrase that I learned, and I'm sure most, if not all of you, also learned this phrase. I was working in the service industry for a while, and the phrase that I learned when it came to submitting to the wishes of the customer was this. And say it with me if you know it. The customer is always... In other words, do everything you can to submit to the desires of the customer. Do everything you can to submit to the desires of the customer. But can I be honest with you guys for just 1 minute? I hated that phrase. I hated that phrase, the customer was always right, because it made me feel like I couldn't do anything unless the customer, if the customer said anything, I had to, you know, immediately go to whatever whim they wanted. And those of us who have worked in the service industry, we can probably all tell various stories about how customers expected things that we simply could not provide, but it didn't matter. The customer was still always right. My sister-in-law, at the same time that I was working in a coffee shop, she was working in the exact franchise over in Ohio, and we once got together and we were just kind of sharing, swapping stories of crazy customers, and her story topped mine. Her story was, one time I had a customer walk in, and they came up to the counter, and they looked at me, and they said, good morning, I would like one small black coffee and a hard-boiled egg. And she looked back at the customer and said, I'm sorry, ma'am, we don't have hard-boiled eggs. And the customer became enraged and said, well, why can't you just go out and buy me an egg and bring it back here and boil it? And my sister-in-law looked back and just said, I don't know. I'm sorry. Here's your coffee. Go get your own egg. But guess who got a little bit chastised for that response? My sister-in-law, because the customer is always right. The customer was furious because she couldn't get a hard-boiled egg in a coffee shop that had no eggs in the building. But yet, all of us, we still aren't surprised by something like that because we grow up in a culture where the customer is always right, where the restaurants are expected to submit to the wishes of the customer regardless of what it is. Now, the truth is, whether you are a customer or whether you're the one who's working behind the counter, submitting to the wishes of another person is very difficult. It can be that way. Having to submit to another person's desires or commands or wishes and whatever it might be, it can be difficult, whether you're the customer or you're the one working. It's true in other areas of our lives, isn't it? Maybe you have a job or you've had a job where the boss or the supervisor is really difficult to work with. And it's very challenging to have to submit to that particular individual on what they want done. Maybe you're in a group of friends or you have a family where you really do struggle sometimes with the decisions that get made, but yet you're not really in a place where you can exercise a sense of leadership, and so you have to often find yourself submit to other decisions. Maybe you just simply find yourself in a position in your life, whether it's at work or it's home or it's whatever the case might be, where there are things that somebody is asking you to do and you don't want to do it that way, and that's the only reason, and it just makes you upset. Many times when we find ourselves having to submit, we find ourselves frustrated, angry, and upset, and we don't even know why, simply because we have to submit to somebody else. Well, our scripture passage today is about a man named Naaman. And Naaman is a man who had grown very accustomed to never having to submit to other people's suggestions, commands, or desires. In fact, Naaman was the one who got other people to submit to him. Naaman was the one who got his desires and his wishes granted, whatever the case might be. He never had to submit. Now, the first thing that I want us to know about this man named Naaman is that he is not from Israel. Naaman is not an Israelite. Naaman is actually lives in another country, a country called Aram. And for those of you who are curious, Aram's northwest of Israel, and it's where modern-day Syria is located. That's where Naaman lives. That's his hometown. But the next thing that I want us to know about Naaman is that while he's living in Aram, and even though he's not an Israelite, he's also an accomplished, successful, respected army commander. So if Naaman's a general, he's got 4 stars. Naaman doesn't have to request a meeting with the king. Naaman just shows up when he wants to talk to the king. Naaman expects to get what he wants when he wants it. He can tell other people to get what he needs, and he gets it. Naaman is high status. He's high profile. He's well respected. Naaman doesn't just have friends in high places. Naaman is the friend in high places. But there's another thing that we need to know about Naaman. Naaman, this high profile, well respected army commander from Aram also has leprosy. The high-profile army commander is a leper. Now, leprosy back in the ancient world was an extremely highly contagious skin disease. Before modern-day medicine, we today don't deal with leprosy because we have modern-day medicine, but back then, if you caught leprosy, it was a very, very big deal, and there was really only one option for you: quarantine. In other words, if you got leprosy, you were going to be isolated and excluded and cut off from the rest of society because of how contagious it was. And so imagine yourself getting a rash today. But instead of just being told, go stay in the bedroom, and after we're done, we're going to wash the bed sheets and the pillowcases, instead, you discover that you have a rash, and you're suddenly forced to say goodbye to your family and go live in a tent outside the city for the rest of your life and not touch people again. This larger-than-life, well-respected army commander Naaman suddenly finds himself with leprosy, and it's no overstatement to say that leprosy is going to completely ruin his social life and his career. But then this small little plot twist takes place. You see, the great Naaman army commander who has led raids on all sorts of other countries, he has actually captured this young girl from Israel, of all places, and she becomes a POW, a prisoner of war. And he carries her back to Aram, and she is now in his household serving Naaman's wife. And when they discover that he has leprosy, this servant girl happens to say, well, you know, there's a prophet in Israel that would be able to cure him. He should go see him. And I'm not surprised that Naaman actually listens to this young servant girl. Naaman, this high-profile, well-respected commander, listens to this young girl. Now, why? Because I need you to imagine something with me. I want you to imagine that you've been diagnosed with something that's going to ruin your career and your social life. And you've exhausted all of your options. You've seen all of the best doctors, both at UPMC and AGH. You've met with other health professionals. Yeah, we're not going to compete here. You've looked at other professionals even outside the city. You've gone to the Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic. You've gone all sorts of other places, and you're running out of options. And then suddenly, for some way or another, you come across some young woman who is from another country. Let's say she's from Mexico, okay? Let's say she's from Mexico. And she says, you know, there's someone I know who lives back in Mexico who could heal you, and you've got nothing to lose, right? So, and you've got the resources to do it, so you pack your bags and you go. But remember, this is Naaman. He's the well-respected, I-don't-submit-to-anybody army commander. He's used to getting his things done his way, and so obviously Naaman First thing he does is he goes and he talks to the king and he makes sure that he turns this into an international political affair. The embassies are involved and Naaman's coming he gets Israel's king involved, and so he gathers up his entourage, he gets his silver, his gold, his bargaining chips, his gifts, the double guarantee that he's going to get whatever he wants, and he heads on his way to this other country. And Naaman finally is in Israel. He's got a couple twists and turns along the way, but finally he discovers where Elisha lives, and he's on his way to Elisha, the prophet, on his way to the house. You can only imagine Naaman's growing excitement. I'm about to get clean. I'm about to be healed. And as he was approaching the house, he sees this lone, solitary figure walking towards them and thinking, oh, great, he's coming out to meet us. How wonderful. But then as they start to see him, they suddenly quickly recognize, wait a minute. This man just introduced himself, and he's not Elisha. He's saying that he's a messenger of Elisha. He's an assistant to Elisha. And he comes up, and he looks at Naaman, and he gives him his orders. He says, Naaman, you army commander, your orders are to go wash in the Jordan River 7 times and be clean. And Naaman is furious. He's enraged. Now, we need to pause the story for just a moment to uncover why is it that Naaman is so upset. Take a look at verse 11 where we really see how upset Naaman is. He says, Naaman became angry and went away saying, I thought that for me he would surely come out and stand and call in the name of the Lord his God and would wave his hand over the spot and cure the leprosy. So why is Naaman so angry? Well, first of all, Naaman is angry because Elisha, the prophet, the person that he traveled so far to come and see, doesn't bother to show his face. Instead, he sends his messenger. He sends to his assistant. And Naaman is downright offended. Now, I have a friend who once got an email that basically said, you have to come to a mandatory meeting where all of your regional colleagues are going to be gathering. My friend had to change his plans because he got this email from his boss. So he changed his plans. He had to travel over an hour to go to this meeting where all of his other regional colleagues were expected to gather. And they get there and they're wondering, what is this? What, you know, how long are we going to have to be here? Yada, yada, yada. Finally, the meeting starts and guess who walks in the room? It wasn't his boss. His boss had sent her assistant because she was too busy to show up. And as you can imagine, my friend and a lot of his colleagues were actually very upset that they had to change all of their plans, but that their boss didn't have to show her face in the midst of this meeting. Now, notice the difference between this story. Naaman's upset because Elisha didn't show. My friend was upset because his boss didn't show. But from Naaman's point of view, he doesn't consider himself the subordinate to Elisha. He thinks that he's the superior one, and this lowly prophet from Israel didn't show his face. Instead of a superior not showing their face, Naaman sees Elisha as the subordinate person, choosing not to show his face to the all-important Naaman. And Naaman is outright and offended by this move. But there's another reason that Naaman's upset and angry. Naaman is actually insulted by the orders that Elisha gives him. The orders are to essentially, if you want to be healed, if you want to be clean, go wash in the Jordan 7 times. Now, why is that so insulting to Naaman? Well, I need you to help me. We're going to imagine again. We're going to pretend we've got our bags packed and we're heading off to Mexico, okay? We've exhausted all of our options. We've talked to every doctor. We've seen every remedy, and it's not working. And so we're traveling to Mexico to find someone who can heal us after no one in the U.S. can. You finally found that person. It's taken you months, and you finally found that person. And even though that person doesn't show and they send their assistant comes, and they're about to tell you, this is all you have to do if you want to be healed. And they're about to say it, and they open their mouth, and they say, all you need to do to be healed is you have to take 2 off-brand aspirins. Can you sense Naaman's anger? What? I did all of this? You couldn't have just sent a letter that said I have to take 2 off-brand aspirins? That's all I did? And he starts to just go off and off. I came all this way to be told by someone's assistant that all I had to do was that. I have to go wash in a river. All I have to do is wash in a river. Couldn't I have even done this back home with my rivers? They're better rivers. That'd be kind of like you and I getting upset and saying, couldn't I have at least stayed home and taken my brand name aspirin instead? This is ridiculous that this is what I have to do after coming all this way. I couldn't have stayed home and do it my way in my rivers. But there's still an even deeper reason why Naaman's upset, a reason that is actually the foundation for all of his anger and frustration. Yes, he's upset that Elisha didn't show his face. Yes, he's upset that the commands are almost too simple, that he wasted all these resources on it. But the real reason why Naaman finds himself so insulted and offended and upset in the midst of this trip is because, quite simply, Naaman is a man completely consumed and filled with pride. Naaman's pride is what makes him so angry that he has to submit to somebody else's assistant. Naaman's pride is what makes him so upset that he has to obey orders to do something as simple as washing in another nation's river. Naaman's filled with pride, and Naaman's pride also means that he is the one who's so used to being in control, and now he finds himself where he suddenly has no control over the methods and over the results. He is used to being the one who tells the king what he needs in order to get the job done. He's the one who brings all of the special gifts to get what he wants. He's the one who brings the big entourage with him so that people will know that he's an important person. But when Elisha sends these orders to go wash in the river 7 times, suddenly Naaman isn't in control anymore. His pride is wounded, and he has to decide whether to or not. Notice the first line of that sentence that he says in verse 11. I had thought that at least for me, he would surely come out and call on the name of the Lord. And Naaman's already decided how his healing should take place. Elisha's going to come out and wave his hand and he'll be healed. That's what he wants to happen. But he can't seem to get what he wants. Naaman isn't able to get the special treatment and attention that he wants because of who he is. There's a story about Muhammad Ali. When Muhammad Ali was at his prime as the heavyweight boxing champion in the world, he took a seat on an airplane. And the plane was getting ready to take off. And the flight attendant was walking the aisles and noticed that Muhammad Ali had not yet fastened his seatbelt. And so she looked at him and she said politely, "Please fasten your seatbelt." And Muhammad Ali responded, "Lady, Superman don't need no seatbelt." And she said back to him without missing a beat, "Sir, Superman don't need no plane." Naaman thinks that he can get special treatment because of who he is. But the truth is, we're not all that different, are we? You might not be an army commander, you might not be a world-class boxer, but most of us do want special treatment. Even if we don't get it, we want it. Or at least we expect it in certain situations. We might not get it at work, but we want it at home. We might not get it at home, but we demand it at work. We name drop people in high places. We buy things to make ourselves look superior to others. We don't really enjoy being told what to do by those who are beneath us. And we often find ourselves frustrated, upset, and angry because we don't like to submit to one another. We too are people filled with pride. And just like Naaman, before we can be healed of our leprosy, we need to be healed of our pride. And I want to suggest 2 remedies that might help us overcome the pride that fills so much of our lives. And no, it does not involve washing in a river. Now, these remedies I'm about to tell you might sound a little bit like common sense, because they are. They're kind of like when the doctor tells you you need to eat right and exercise. Everyone agrees that we should do it, but very few people actually do. And furthermore, if you do decide to do them, you're not going to see results overnight. It's not a quick fix, and you can't avoid the hard work. So the remedies that I'm about to suggest to help us to overcome the pride in your life are likewise can feel a little bit abstract and even challenging. They are this: regard others better than yourself. Regard others as better than yourself, and 2, regularly practice letting go of control. Now, just like the commands to eat right and exercise, there's a myriad of ways that you can implement those practices based on your life circumstances. But I do want to provide with all of you just a few suggestions on how you might do those two things, whether or not they work or not. The important piece is to do them and see what happens. Regard others as better than yourself and to practice letting go of control. Well, the first that I want to mention in terms of trying to regard others as better than yourself is to do this. Can you go a whole day without talking about yourself? See if you can do it. Go one whole day without talking about you. Second option, if there's somebody in your life who is considered your subordinate, would you ask them if there's anything you can do for them? Third option, if there's someone in your life who's really, 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 really difficult and you find yourself having to submit to them, would you try to do something kind for that person with no expectation of something in return? That's just trying to regard others better than yourself. What about trying to let go of control? Here's one. Let the other person finish the conversation and don't interrupt them to tell them your opinion. Another option. This one might seem a little funny, but trust me, it might be the hardest one on this list. You ready? Everywhere you go, drive under the speed limit. And see what it feels like to not control what time you get somewhere. Or if you want to really up the ante, for those of you who live in a place you can do this, try to take the bus someday. Number three, many of you are about to go out to eat after worship. When you go out to eat, ask your spouse or another family member or your friend to order what they think you should eat. And then eat it. Don't get to pick what you're going to eat out when you go out. Again, ways to just practice how to let go of control. Now, these might be smaller, silly examples, but again, if we can't do those small things, how are we ever going to submit to others in the way that Jesus calls us to? Paul summed it up in one of his letters when he said, "In humility, regard others as better than yourselves, and that let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus." So what's the first step that you can do to be a humble servant and regard others as better than yourself? What's the first step you can do to begin practice letting go of control, putting to death the pride in your life as you begin to experience what it means to be washed clean? Because no matter who you are, you're called to submit to others the way that Jesus did. Whether you're a well-esteemed doctor or a fast food employee, whether you're a parent or a child, whether you're a great army commander or a young girl enslaved as a prisoner of war, serve like Jesus. Let go of your pride and embrace a life that is made clean through humble obedience. Amen.